This is Diana Cordy with Book Talk. My guest is neuroscientist and musician Daniel J. Levitin, author of A Field Guide to Lies. Listeners might be familiar with some of his earlier work, including This Is Your Brain on Music. Welcome to our program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Diana.
You've been on many a TV show. Is TV the hotbed of media lies today? Or are they everywhere?
Well, I don't think, unfortunately, TV doesn't have an exclusive on distortions and lies. We hear it on the radio, unfortunately, and in newspapers and magazines and on the internet. And, you know, a recent survey shows that an increasing number of people under the age of 25 get all their news, not just some of it, but all their news from Facebook.
Your book's subtitle is Critical Thinking in the Information Age. Speaking of under 25-year-olds, is this the biggest information age ever?
Oh, it absolutely is by any measure. I mean, just one way to look at it is that we've created more information in the last 5 years than in all of human history before it. And unfortunately, alongside all that information, as you know, Diana, is a lot of misinformation and a lot of distortions, and so it's getting harder and harder for the average person to know which is which. We rely on journalists like you and, you know, newspapers and pundits to help us out, but the bad stuff is coming in faster than the good stuff, it seems.
Why did you write this book now?
Well, I wrote it because I think we're at a turning point in education at the college level, certainly, and at high school and K-12, which is that we've spent the last couple of hundred years following what's become an outmoded model of trying to stuff a bunch of facts into young heads. And now we're at a point in time where everybody has access to all the information they want through their mobile devices. They can get the facts very easily. They don't have to memorize them anymore. They don't have to search for them in a book. But what most young people don't know how to do is to apply the information they've learned in creative ways, and even before doing that, to know what's true information and what's false. They don't have the critical thinking skills. So I wrote the book now because I think the next big challenge is to teach everybody in our society how to do the kinds of things that journalists and lawyers and scientists do when they encounter information, how to think about it in a logical and rational way so that we're not taken in by things that are lies.
In your book, you have a section on how to interpret words, and another section on how to interpret numbers. The next time I go to an article on the web, using the information in your book about interpreting those numbers and words, what's the first thing I'm going to ask myself?
You know, I think, Diana, the first thing you want to ask yourself is the claim plausible? Does it make sense, especially if it's numeric? Do the numbers make sense? So if you hear somebody, and I cite this example in the book, that the price of something went down 12,000%. Whatever the price of something is, whether it's a dollar or $1,000, if the price goes down 100%, it's gone to zero. So if it goes down 12,000%, that means somebody's paying you an awful lot of money. So that's simply not plausible.
What's another thing I should ask myself?
Well, you can use plausibility in other ways. The person who cuts my hair said to me just last week that she heard that there were 12 billion people on the planet who lacked access to toilets. And, you know, I don't know what the exact population of the world is. The last time I looked, it was 7 billion or so.
Uh-huh.
And it might have crept up to 8 billion without my knowing it. Maybe there was a mass die-off of people somewhere that I missed, and it's down to 6 billion. But it certainly isn't up, you know, above 10. So the claim just isn't plausible on the face of it. Now, you can go beyond numbers and you can look at words.
Well, I remember back in the day as a kid going to the library, and I assumed that what I read there was true.
That was a great rubric, a great heuristic. You could. Libraries were curated. It was an imperfect system, but whether it was a public school library or a public library in your community, there were choices being made because they couldn't stock everything that was ever published. They made choices, and the people who made them were information scientists. They were trained. For those of you that haven't interacted with a librarian since grammar school, they're not just people who shush you. They're They're typically people who have advanced training, and at the universities where I've worked, they're considered equivalent to professors. I could never have gotten any of the scientific work I've done in my career without the help of librarians. They help you to choose reliable sources and distinguish them from unreliable. But the funny thing happened on the way to the 21st century. We've got this great thing called the internet, but there's nobody curating it. There's no gatekeeper. So you can't just trust everything you find on it, and you can't even trust everything you find on, say, Wikipedia.
So
I've rendered you atypically silent, haven't I?
So I'm just thinking about sources for what I read this article that I'm going to be evaluating. How do I evaluate the source of the information?
Well, there are several things you can do, and I try to outline these in the book in a systematic way. I'm certainly happy to tell you. I mean, I'm not here to try and sell copies of the book. I'm happy to give away all the information for free because I think information should be free. That said, if you want to buy the book, it's got a handy compendium that has it all in one place. But so what I recommend is, first of all, there's a hierarchy of information sources, and some are more reliable than others. Certainly, if you're looking up information on diseases, a government site like the Centers for Disease Control, that's probably the most accurate source. They don't have a dog in the race, as it were. They're not a for-profit entity. If you're trying to get information about statutes and regulations concerning taxes, you're probably going to get more accurate and reliable information from irs.gov than paythelowesttaxespossible.com, which might be a scam. You don't know. It might not be, but you don't know. Similarly, you know, NPR, CNN, the New York Times, these big, large-scale operations devoted to the news, they tend to be pretty good, as opposed to, say, the National Enquirer, which tends not to have as high an accuracy rating, or TMZ, for that matter. So understanding that there's a hierarchy helps.
Right. Let's talk about lies. Why are some politicians' lies more believable or more easily dismissed than other politicians? I'm thinking now about the presidential race in the U.S.
Well, it's tricky, and there's a very interesting research literature on this. Some people are better liars than others for reasons that we don't understand, and some people are fabulous liars because they don't know that they're lying. They suffer from a pathological condition where they're really not aware of the difference between a lie and the truth, and so they can tell lies very convincingly. And politics, unfortunately, is the kind of career where that's rewarded. And so it just so happens that in politics, because it's so complicated, and there aren't checks and balances that can effectively deal with all that complication, some politicians can get away with it, but less so. Now that we have sites like PolitiFact and the Washington Post runs a fact-checking site, it's getting harder and harder, and we run up against a different problem, which is that a substantial portion of the electorate doesn't care if the candidate is lying. They don't care if the facts line up because they're responding to the decision emotionally rather than rationally because they're not sure how to evaluate with them. And all I'm trying to do is provide a kind of a user's manual or a field guide for people who are like that, who don't know what to do if a number's thrown at them and don't know how to evaluate it.
You say statistics are not facts. What are they?
It's funny, isn't it? We tend to think of statistics as facts. We tend to think of numbers as incontrovertible. Nowhere is this more apparent than when we talk about averages. And we encounter averages all the time. And if you think you know what they mean, pause for a minute and understand that an average is a distortion. It's always a distortion because you're taking a whole bunch of numbers and collapsing them to a single number. So if I tell you that the average height in a room is 5'2", and I got a room full of, say, four-year-olds and a room full of NBA forwards, I'm averaging a bunch of, say, 7-foot people and a bunch of, you know, 3-foot people or something, and I ended up with an average of 5'2", which is, yeah, it's mathematically in the middle, but there is no one person, there's nobody in the room who's actually 5'2".
Well, thank you. My guest is Daniel J. Levitin, author of A Field Guide to Lies, published by Dutton. This is Diana Cordy with Book Talk.